Welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farrand, owner of the company Horns of Odin. As always, before we get into today's show, I do have to do a little bit of housekeeping, and that relates to our Patreon, which is the way that we keep the podcast going. You can sign up there for £3 a month, which works out about 10p a day, and it really does help behind the scenes with the editing, the social media, the advertising, all those bits and pieces that go into making a successful podcast. So for that £3 a month, you're going to get a bonus episode every week where we do a Q&A with our guests. It's after the show. You can submit your questions before or in real time as you can watch the show live, joining the live chat feature. You're also going to get access to our Discord server, which is a lovely little community we've collected over the years. You're going to get early access to all the episodes, ad-free access, and the tier up from that, you're going to get a storytime episode with myself and Jonas Lorentzen, where we read through a different story from Nordic mythology, and it's a lot of fun. We tend to have beer and wine, and it just turns into a little bit of chaos, but it is a very fun time. And then in the new year, we're going to be looking at changing our recording time to a Sunday to help more people be able to join and watch live, as well as shuffle some of those tiers around. So, and also we're going to look at introducing a new show, which is going to be a lot of fun. So that's kind of it for that. If you can check out the Patreon, it's patreon.com/Nordic Mythology Podcast, and we do very much appreciate it. But let's get into today's show. And today we have somewhat of a returning guest. I've spoken to this gentleman before, but unfortunately the episode had a little bit of sound quality issues, so I don't think we ever aired it. So it's the first time ish, and that's Paul Mortipos. Paul, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, like I say, we spoke. I'm sure it was 2.5 years ago. It was a long time ago, and I think we said that we were just talking about before the show how it's from memory. There was some issue. I think it was like the laptop fan was just constantly running all the way through and muffled pretty much most of the amazing things you were saying.
I don't think they were all that amazing. I'm sure the fan had performed better than I did, but can't do better today.
No, I'm sure it'll be absolutely fine. Can you just give people a little bit of a introduction to you, what you do, what you specialize in?
I've been interested in the period from about 500, from about 400 to the end of the 7th century, for a very long time. And myself and some friends started a group called Wolfi Adonas, and we occasionally perform for people in 7th century mostly. And I've written a couple of books and some papers, which you can find on my academia page or on my research gate page. So that's about it, really. My latest book, or our latest book, which I co-wrote with a chap called Matt Bunker, it was about swords in Anglo-Saxon England from the 5th and 7th century. But whether you're looking at Viking period swords or Viking period weaponry or the earlier period, it's pretty much the same sort of stuff, really. I mean, it changes a bit in detail, but the basic designs of weapons stay the same and the basic functions stay the same. So there you go.
Yeah, I feel like you do yourself such a disservice. You also specialize in the Sutton Hoo burial, am I right?
Oh, yeah. I've done my best I wanted to understand how the things in the grave at Sutton Hoo worked.
Well, I've had quite a lot of bits replicated from the helmet. When I was about in the 1970s, when I saw the new replica at Bridging Museum, I thought it was so strange and wonderful that I wanted one. And I didn't get one for several decades, but I did eventually. In fact, I've had three now. But we think the one that I have now is actually the most accurate replica that there is. But other people may think differently. But we've had the sword, the shields, the jewelry, the chains, loads of stuff. But I wanted to understand how it worked. And myself and friends have come up with ways of making it all work together. And I wanted to see what it all looked like together on a person. So We've done that.
Wow.
That looks very nice, that glass of wine you're drinking.
It's almost like a goblet of wine. I've had a it's Christmas period, so having a retail business, it's extremely stressful.
I'm
So
a bit disappointed you're not drinking it out of a horn, but there
I
you go.
know I should have done. I should have done, but I didn't have one to hand. So it's a Stella Artois kind of goblet style glass.
Very functional.
Okay, before we get into weaponry, I'm absolutely fascinated with these replicas that you've made. So because they're absolutely amazing, we'll put some of the pictures on our Instagram. They're not, I imagine they're not cheap to make,
No,
but
they weren't cheap.
the workmanship on them is absolutely amazing. So you've clearly put together a good team.
Yeah, well, as I say, Dave Roper made most of the metalwork, and he's a bit of a wizard.
Absolutely.
And I was very fortunate in those days that he was actually doing it as a hobby, so I never got charged the full price or anything. But these days, if you ask him if he'll make anything, he has to. He does it as a living now, so he has to charge you,
Yeah.
whatever it does, whatever it takes. But the helmet was very interesting because when we were working on the helmet, the business of the two eyebrows fascinated me. One's different to the other, I'm sure you know. And
I mean, feel free to quickly go into it
well,
because.
one eyebrow, the eyebrows have garnets at the bottom of them, and one eyebrow has gold foils behind the garnets to reflect light back at you. The other one doesn't. It's the left one that doesn't, and so it's actually quite dark. And this seemed to me to connect to some other things that I'd been thinking about. And I mean, I think there's a lot of symbolism on the helmet, which relates to the Anglo-Saxon god Woden. There's increasing evidence, we believe, that the story of the later story of Odin sacrificing an eye for a drink from the well of wisdom was actually known much earlier. So it's not just a helmet. There's other things too which seem to lead to that conclusion. And much of it is from the early period, from the 6th century, 7th century.
Yeah, I mean, it makes complete sense that it comes from earlier. I think you only have to look at the j just travel across Europe and Northern Europe and see how the stories have kind of traveled to understand that it didn't, Odin certainly didn't just appear in
Absolutely not.
Scandinavia.
No, I mean, but the stories that they knew about in the 6th or 7th century may not have been exactly the same as the ones that were written down much later on, but they would have been, the basics ideas of it. I mean, there's one of the interesting things is in the pagan temple at Opocra in Sweden, southern Sweden. They've found one eyebrow from a helmet, and what I ended up writing a paper with Neil Price, and we came to the conclusion that a similar thing had happened to a helmet there, in that they probably went through a ritual where they reenacted the sacrificing of an eye, and they'd taken the old eye off the helmet, placed it somewhere, and replaced it with a new one. But in Opocra, we have the eyebrow, but not the rest of the helmet.
Okay.
So it's and that's from the same period as Sun Hoon, so it's 6th, 7th century, late 6th, early 7th.
That's fascinating that you would only find the eyebrow. So does it detach quite easy?
No. You'd have to actually take it off. They're on there very firmly, so you'd have to have someone with a chisel, and
Okay.
or someone with a file taking the rivets out of the back.
So would that mean that there's some, I assume there's some sort of significance to this eyebrow piece?
Well, I think, well, I mean, I've written quite a lot about helmet, but I suspect that when the man who owned it, and generally it's thought to be a king called Radwald, who was buried in Mound 1 at Sunhu, but there are other candidates, but he's the one that people seem to fix on. When he put that helmet on, he's particularly if he's conducting rituals or going to war, he's no longer just Radwell, the king. He's become the god. He's become Woden on Earth. And you know, if you're on his side, that's quite comforting. If you're against him, it would be a little bit awesome and maybe terrifying, unless they've got their own version of Woden, which they could perfectly entitled to do, I suppose.
I guess it doesn't really matter what god they feel becoming. It's kind of fascinating, this idea of embodiment of some sort of higher power that gives you some sort of benefit or advantage in war or in like a ceremony.
Absolutely. I mean, the other thing is that all the brightness, the beauty of this stuff is meant to be quite terrifying and awe people. And if you've got lots of people on your, I mean, he would also have to have people by him who looked pretty much nearly as good. And the more of those he's got, then it's you know, quite terrifying for the opposition. Mm-hmm. And perhaps they'll think, you know, if they see a glittering host with the sun shining on them and you know, bit flashes of gold and all the rest of it, that they'll think perhaps we can, rather than fight him, perhaps we can come to some other sort of arrangement. But that's what all that stuff was for.
Yeah, I was going to say this question for later on, but we're doing things in a different order than I expected. But that's how it goes, and that's why I love this podcast, because it's just free flowing. So obviously, anybody that's seen The Sun Who Helmet, most people that listen to this will have. It's an incredible piece.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you look at the sword, the shield, all these items are so ornate and beautiful. Would they have been used in war?
Well, I believe absolutely. I mean, the way the helmet is configured, you know, I mean, they may not, the way it's been reproduced may not be 100% correct, but the basic helmet is very protective. It protects your neck, your back of your neck, your whole face, your cheeks, and it's a good helmet to wear in battle. And we do know that these, you know, by and large, these people dressed up to go to battle. They put their best clothes on because for a whole number of reasons. One, they want to be seen. And, you know, in a time when there's not a lot of writing going on, they want to be remembered if something happens, either if they, you know, they kill one of the enemy or several people, they want to be seen doing it. And if they fall, they want to be remembered about the way that they fell in battle. So they want people to, you know, make poetry about them and talk about them in the hall. So the stuff is the, you know, what Radwell wore and what other warriors wore would be their personal heraldry. Of renowned warriors, everyone would know who they were on both sides. And, you know, they'd be watching. There were people watching to see what they did and how they behaved in battle and how they, you know, either conquered or fell.
Would that not put a target on their back, though?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the other things you have to understand that these people, they understand that they may die. But they're of the mental, they're not, you know, it's not like us. The way they're looking at life is totally different. Elite warriors at that time would, particularly the young men who are on the make and trying to, you know, to become better known and more renowned and make a name for themselves. They are ambitious people, but they also understand that they may die. And they're quite prepared for it. They have to be.
Yeah, because if I was a king, I'd have wanted to blend in with everyone else so that everyone wasn't just like, get him.
That's not what they did, is it? I mean, in the later periods too, you know, in the Viking period, well-known warriors are spotted and seen. They're spoken about. If they fall, they're spoken about in sagas. So it's, you know, they have a form of immortality.
Yeah, it's such a different mentality because even... You know, as we get later on, we see generals and leaders moving further and further back, and just being kind of the the kings, almost in like a chess set, being the ones who move the pieces and just stay safe and out of sight. But back in this time period, they're very much at the front, willing to die, wanting to be seen.
Absolutely. They'd have several big chaps who are also very, very good warriors, you know, helping them out a bit. So,
okay.
I mean, in the later stories, we're given the impression that their guards are expected to die with them if they fall in battle. But I don't think they always did, but anyway. But there's lots of people around them who are supporting them. And but particularly when they're young, I think kings would, and not just kings, but lords would be expected to lead their men. As they got older, I suspect they took a slightly less prominent role at the front of the battle.
Yeah, I guess obviously the more times they do it and the more times they're successful, then it is very much a mental warfare as much as it is a physical one. I watch a lot of combat sports, whether it's boxing or MMA, and there is a side of it which happens before you get to the ring, the octagon, where there's a lot of mental games played to just get that one up before you even get in there. And some fights are won before people even step in because of that.
Indeed, showmanship.
Yeah.
You know, showing off and staring each other out and doing whatever. And they did the same, I'm sure, in an army sort of way, not just but they probably sent people across the battlefield to talk to the opposition and insult each other. I mean, we know they did, but no, I mean, if they can intimidate their enemy enough, then the battle's won before it starts. So,
yeah, absolutely. If you're just, again, you probably could correct me on this. I don't know how much when it comes to these battles, whether they were all full-time soldiers or there was a lot of people who just pulled in who were farmers and just kind of pushed in there and said, you have to fight. But if you were certainly not a career soldier, I guess, it would be very intimidating as a, you know, somebody who just kind of knows how to swing a sword around and stick someone with a pointy end to then come up against someone in the armor, kind of from Sutton, who you would maybe think twice about approaching them.
Well, you would indeed. And I mean, one of the things about this, the period that I look at, and probably to some extent the Viking period too, is that you only get this stuff if you're really good at fighting. Yeah. You know, your wealth increases, your renown increases as you get better and better and better, and you accumulate more. If you do well in battle, your lord gives you stuff. If you're a successful king, then you get wealth from taxes and from pillage and whatever. But also, you're expected to share that wealth. Mean kings didn't last very long. They would find themselves having an accident or, you know, whatever. But open-handed kings were renowned. I mean, if you read Beowulf, there's that's exactly what's going on in there. Hrothgar, the king of Denmark, advises Beowulf to be generous. And he is generous when Beowulf has done things for him. Now, you can argue about the historicity of Beowulf, but nevertheless, that's portraying the things that were happening in the 6th century.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I have a completely off-topic question that's just come to mind, and then we can get into what I originally wanted to start the show with. And you maybe know the answer to this or not. You know, when you see in films, when you have two armies set up and then they just send out a champion, and those champions fight, and then whichever champion wins, the other army just decides to go home because they're like, we lost. Is that based on any history? Is that a real thing?
Well, I don't honestly know. I mean, there are instances in some of the histories, particularly the ones from the continent, that give the impression that sort of thing happened. And there is an episode in Beowulf, well, not an episode. We're told that Beowulf killed Raffan, the Frankish champion, in battle. Well, we don't know if it's in battle or by single combat. You have got Offa of Angeln, who defeats two opponents on an island. But that was perhaps a different thing. It wasn't, I don't think it was going to be a battle, but he wanted to, his ancestors had ganged up on somebody on the opposite side, two of them against one. So he, in order to retrieve the honor of his ancestors, he fought two people from the other tribe and defeated them.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you know, I'm sure single combat went on, but whether it was always tied up with a battle or not, then.
Yeah, I've always just found it a little bit odd, the idea of everybody gets kitted up ready for a battle and then we all just wait to see the two champions fight and take that. But yeah, I don't know, maybe it's a Hollywood thing.
I mean, if it was happening and you know that resolves it, then it's actually a lot of stress. It's just, you know, for the other people who can now go home. It's better than actually being. I mean, battle fighting is really hard work.
Mm-hmm.
And you can never be certain. Even if you're really good, you can never be certain of the outcome of any fight. You might slip, trip, or a 14-year-old with an arrow on the side might hit you in a leg or something and cripple you.
Yeah,
at a critical moment.
Yeah, this is a topic I'm quite fascinated with, in terms of what an actual battle would have looked like. And I guess for me, the closest thing that I can relate to is movies that I've seen and how they're portrayed in that. And I guess the one that stands out for me as being what I think would be the most realistic is it the Battle of the Bastards in Game of Thrones, where it's very chaotic and close. And I think Jon Snow gets almost stampeded and I think suffocated. And I feel like that's what I imagine a battle would have been like. But then I always kind of then wonder how much skill would have really mattered, or is it just luck? Because in that kind of melee, I feel like skill's very nullified almost.
If everything's close, I mean, I don't know. I've never been in the battle. So many years ago, I was a soldier, but we didn't. It was quite a peaceful time, so almost a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
But and we had guns anyway. So
it's very different, isn't it now?
Very, very different. But I mean, I don't know. But if there's a press of people in a small space, then you know you really are dependent on how much pressure is coming from the other side, and if you fall over, you've had it. So
yeah,
I think you're right, actually, and I think the Game of Thrones battle scenes are sometimes very good indeed.
Yeah, because you see it sometimes, and I particularly picked up on it in the Vikings TV show, where they just have like 5 minutes to have like a solo battle in the middle of the battle, and I just always thought, well, maybe why doesn't someone just kind of just get you in the back whilst you're having this big fight?
Well, some of the literature, particularly the later literature, does, you know, from the Viking period, does tend to give you the impression that that happened. You know,
oh, okay.
But you'd have to have a bit of room, you know, and maybe, I'm sure it did happen from time to time, but I mean, the ordinary common soldier's experience of battle would have been terrifying, absolutely mm-hmm. terrifying.
Oh, I can't even begin to imagine how horrific it was. Because I think no matter what research goes into or whatever a TV show does, I don't think you could ever replicate what it would actually be like when it comes to the just the amount of wounds. Because not every
Absolutely.
Kill is going to be a clean kill, or there's going to be bits hanging off. And
no. These weapons, swords and spears particularly, are designed to inflict maximum tissue damage and blood loss as quickly as possible. You don't mm-hmm. have to kill anybody. As you know, if you hit someone with one of our swords from our period, even if it's an arm, they're in serious trouble and
okay.
they'll be bleeding. And all you've got to do, if you know, is actually step back a bit and let them attack you, but defend yourself, because soon they're going to fall over.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a case of loads of quick, clean kills.
Absolutely
It's
not.
It's a bunch of people in a lot of pain.
Having said that, though, I mean, when you look at the cemetery, from some of the cemeteries, you know, some of the skulls and people where they've been hacked, some with a sharp, probably a sword, they would have been incapacitated pretty quickly. Particularly, I mean, I saw one, I can't remember the cemetery, where the skull had actually been cleaved in the front, and that would have been quick, I think.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't a case of suicide.
Oh. Okay. I want to, I guess, go to the question that I wanted to start with until we got completely off topic. And that was one that I touched on just before the show started, and that was just to get a lay of what the landscape of weaponry would have looked like in this general period from maybe like 500 through to into the Viking Age. In a sense of what people would have carried, what the most common weapon maybe would have been, whether there was many two-handed weapons or if it was predominantly what a lot of people think is just a shield and I assume just a short single-handed weapon.
Well, everyone has a spear. That's your main weapon. A modern infantryman's weapon is his rifle, but for everybody then, it would have been a spear, whether on horseback or on foot, and a shield. And I think pretty much everybody who saw themselves as a soldier, even if it was only for a few years, would have had access to a sword. I don't think swords were uncommon at all. Scholars have perpetually insisted that swords are rare because they're not very common in graves. But graves and funerals are not part of that. They don't really reflect real life. They reflect funerals and what happens at a funeral. Sword burials are, as I say, quite rare, and we're still trying to grapple with what that means. But if you make a sword and you look after it, and we have lots of evidence from the literature and from some of the finds themselves that swords were lasted a very long time, a couple of hundred years even. Do you know about the Salme burial, ship burials on the island of Salme near Estonia, where there's two boats?
I've read a little bit about it, but not much in depth.
Something like 40 people buried in both boats, and there's more swords. Well, it's actually, I've been reading the book, but it's actually very difficult to be exactly sure how many swords there were, but there's more swords than men. And it's an absolutely exceptional set of finds, and they're the DNA analysis and isotope analysis suggests they come from Sweden, from around the Lake Mälaren area. So they were mostly Swedes, and I think four seem to have come from Gotland. But that's I don't think swords were rare at all, and I think some people would have had several. Some of the wealthier people would have had several, and I think it would have been a king's job, like Radwald, for instance, to actually loan swords out to people. And but you can also acquire a sword through killing someone in battle, although. I'm going on a bit. I do apologize.
No, this is the whole point of it. Please do.
But well, acquiring a sword, I mean, there's several ways of doing it. You could go and purchase one or order one from the blacksmith, but I don't think many people would have actually been in a position to do that. So I think there's quite a lot of evidence that families had swords which they passed down. And
I guess that would make sense why you don't find many in burials then, because it was
yeah, they're
something that you
valuable
kept
things. They're
rather than.
valuable things. And the older they are, the more valuable they are
Yeah. And I
because
guess
they.
if you feel they have some power as well
Yeah.
from the person who had it before.
I mean, one of the. There's an archaeologist. She's actually English, but she lives. Well, I think she's become Swede, Ali Klefner. She's done some work on grave robbery and what they found in England and in Sweden. She has a whole team. And in parts of northern, in Belgium and Holland, is that when graves are robbed, they appear to be looking for things like swords and high status women's brooches because they always take them. They leave lots of stuff, sometimes even gold stuff that's very valuable. But certainly, they're not looking for iron. They don't want them, but they're taking these things because they are valuable. And they're depriving the dead of their power. and the family, their descendants.
Is that a monetary value, or is that also like a power value to this, or like a spiritual or magic, whatever word you want to put on it?
No, it's not a monetary value. I mean, there's this old English word called madmas, which means treasure, but it doesn't necessarily mean gold and silver. It means stuff that has a sword that's killed somebody or formed well or belonged to someone very famous, like a king or lord or whatever, or famous warrior. That acquires a reputation and a value way above gold and silver. So these things are known, and they have a power all of their own.
Do we see this thing of naming swords? Is that...
Well, there is. Unfortunately, in the old English literature, there aren't many swords that are named. But the Fedir Andrashok, who wrote a book about swords, Viking swords in Sweden, he says there's we know 176 names of swords from the sagas. From the earlier period, there's swords like Skofnul, which belonged to Wolf Kraki, which has a long life. It goes through about five different owners, and it's mentioned in about I think it's five or six different sources, different sagas. But Wolf Kraki lived, if he lived, in the 6th century. There's the Beowulf sword, which fouls him when he tries to kill the dragon, called Nailing, which means the nail. And it does appear to be a sea axe, a long sea axe rather than a two-edged sword. But yeah, I mean, they do name swords, but we aren't always told what they are. There's another quite famous sword in Beowulf called, we don't know what it was called. We're told its history. It belonged to Wiglaf, who was the one companion who stayed with Beowulf at the end. And it tells you the history of this sword and all the people it's killed, including the Swedish king. But they don't tell us what it was called. So that's a bit odd, but there you go.
Do we have any surviving swords that we know this sword called?
No.
What? No.
No. Sometimes swords in England are usually in a very poor state because of the soils. And, they're also buried in scabbards, which are made of wood and leather and fur, and all the metal always, it corrodes with these things, so it's impossible to separate them. But even where they're quite well preserved, like many of the later Viking swords swords from the Viking period were thrown in rivers or come out of rivers, and they're often quite well preserved. But any names tend to be the maker's name, not the names of the people who owned them. Although there are, I think there's about five swords from England which do have runes scratched on the pommel. But it tends to be the word alu, which means ale. So maybe they're okay, just writing down their favourite beer. We don't really know.
Maybe. Isn't there like some famous myth? Okay, you may be able to tell me whether this is true or not, because every so often I see a meme that comes up on Facebook about these really special swords from the Viking Age, in our Anglo-Saxon, particularly, it's always mentioned like in England. Are they Uthbert swords?
Uthbert swords,
yeah. And people say how
from the
these
10th
are.
Century.
Yeah, people talk about how they're some incredible Damascus, and they still could be sharpened.
They're not Damascus. Quite the reverse. They're single. They're monometal. I mean, they will have been folded many times. They're pretty much all steel. So they are quite special. It's high quality metal. But the old swords are from, the pattern of them. These are showing you a blade. Can you see that? Can you see the blade?
Oh, I can, yeah.
That's pretty much all swords, apart from things like the Ulfbert swords, are made of many bits of metal, many different metal. And they tend to have a hardened edge, but in the middle, They often have pattern, which is twisted bars, basically, or straight bars, something like that. And they're made of a different type of iron, softer. And in order to get the contrast, they use either dark or, well, low carbon iron, or the most common use for bright iron then was phosphoric iron, because it doesn't rust very keeps shining. But
So
ideally, they've got steel edges.
would a full steel sword like the upper ones be better? Would that make them a higher quality, or is it just what was available?
Well, there are scholars who there's a chap at the Wallace Collection who wrote a lot about the Wolfbert swords, and he seems to think they're very special. I mean, the difficulty we have is it's very difficult to test these things out on people. I mean, you can do it on a pig, but no, I think the pattern welded swords are actually very effective weapons. I mean, and it must have worked, because most swords from our period are patterned, not just in England, but in Scandinavia and on the continent, in Northern Europe anyway. And they're in use for a very long time, hundreds of years. And even when they there was still pattern welded swords being made in the Viking period. And I mean, apart from the axe, handsome to look at, you know. And the
Oh,
pattern probably meant something.
it's absolutely beautiful. And just for anybody that's listening to it, you can pop over to our YouTube and watch all the episodes that we do. And that's just Nordic Mythology Podcast on YouTube. Obviously, hit the little subscribe and the bell button, please. But you can watch them and see all the cool things that guests hold up, because it does happen quite often where we'll have a guest that has something really remarkable that wants to show it off.
But I'll send you some pictures so you can add those to the.
Yeah, we will.
Talking of showing things off, I thought I'd show you some.
Oh wow, okay. We can have a little show and tell.
Yeah, a little bit. Here's the purse.
So are these all bits that you've had recreated?
They are, yeah.
I assume you must have had some special access to the originals.
We did with a sword, and I mean, we looked at all the reports for all this, and we tested them against it. Yeah, but with the sword, we actually were allowed access to the original.
Wow.
I mean, we did have some access with the other things and the helmet, but these are some of my favorite things. The Can you see?
Oh wow,
Don't
yeah.
look at
So what was that?
That was a shoulder clasp. There's two of them, and they
Okay.
came out of the ground pretty much perfectly, because they're gold and garnets and glass. They weren't corroded at all, and they have these staples on the back for connecting them to something.
I think when I was last at the British Museum, my friend Richard Wakeman kind of pointed these out and showed a few of the bits.
Well, they are. I mean, that this. In I've always been interested in the period, but it was the Sutton Hoo stuff that got me really going. And I thought the garnet and gold jewellery was so beautiful.
They are stunning.
It's the same as with some much of the Swedish stuff. In fact, we're going to Sweden next month to have a look at some of the Valsioda helmets and swords out of the cases. So we've seen them in some of them out of the cases, but they've been on a exhibition in Denmark, but before the ones that we've never been allowed to see outside, but we're going to get to see them
Oh,
next
wonderful.
month.
That's exciting.
Please.
So you've referenced Sweden, I think, twice. Is there a do we know the reason why so much of this kind of is represented in Sweden? Does it What kind of links does it show between Anglo-Saxon Britain and Sweden pre-Viking Age?
In the 5th to 7th century, there were no Anglo-Saxons in England. There were people who later come to be called Anglo-Saxons, but they were people from Jutland, from other parts of Denmark, the Angles, the Saxons, and many, many other types of people from Scandinavia and Northern, what we now call Northern Europe. And they would never have thought of themselves as being, a united people. They were all different. And I personally, I think the people at Sutton Hoo saw themselves as Scandinavians in much the same way that, many recent immigrants to a country, whether they're second or third generation, they actually, you've got Irish Americans. You've got that they still see their roots as being somewhere else. And I'm sure that was what was happening. And the Anglo-Saxon England didn't coalesce for a long time. But I'm pretty certain that the people at Sutton, personally, I'm actually writing a paper on it at the moment about the connections between Sutton Hoo and Uppland in Sweden. I'm sure they all knew each other or probably related.
So the Vikings weren't the first time Scandinavians came
No.
to.
No, I mean the Romans are writing about Scandinavian and North German raiders, which they called Saxon pirates. They called, and they were raiding across the North Sea and the Channel for hundreds of years before the Vikings. And then I mean that's the start of the migration period, really, at the end of the, before the Roman period ended. And eventually the people are coming across and moving about all over Europe. And it's I think names like Anglo-Saxons or England or whatever, they sort of get in the way of our understanding. We've got to sort of clear our minds a little bit and go back to what it would have been as far as we can tell. But
I
certainly,
think it's just easier. It's easier to say like Anglo-Saxon rather than all the
shorthand.
different individual groups, but it is inaccurate.
I mean, certainly the people in East Anglia would never have understood what you were talking about if you had a time machine and said, "You're an Anglo-Saxon." They, no, I'm not. I'm a Wolfing, whatever they were calling themselves. Bede calls them East Anglians, but he's writing about 100 years later, so
Do we
maybe a
know
little bit longer.
when the term Anglo-Saxon was first used?
Yeah, I think it's actually used in the 8th century. I don't think it was Bede, but it's later on. And but certainly England doesn't become a united country until I think it's Athelstan, Alfred's great grandson, Alfred's grandson. I think it was grandson. I tend to lose interest after conversion, so it's my
That's
knowledge there is a bit shaky.
fair enough. Okay, you touched on, or you mentioned them before, and is it a Seax? Is that how you pronounce it? I always look at that word and I get so, I always panic. I never know which way to
Well, it's
say it.
spelt Sax or Seax, isn't it? So it'd be either.
Okay.
Most people tend to settle on Seax.
So what's the difference between that and a sword? Because you mentioned in Beowulf there's one that you think is a Saxon and not a sword.
Well, many of the swords at Salme are single-edged swords. And they particularly at various times in the Viking Age, they're very popular in Norway amongst the Norwegians. But the people in Salme were Swedes, but they nevertheless are using single-edged swords. A Seax has a single edge, a single cutting edge. And, I don't, if they're long, I don't think they're Seaxes, I think they're swords. But most swords throughout Europe from the 5th to the 11th century are double-edged, and they tend to have several characteristics. Not always, I mean, some of them change, but they have fairly small grips. So a big man's hand would have a bit of trouble gripping it. They tend to be in England. The horn is by far the most. From the burial finds, horn is by far the most popular organic grip. I've gone off the subject of sea axes. I do apologise.
No, don't worry.
But
It's
pull
always
me back.
it's always fun when that happens because it's just
But
like good to see your brain doing its thing.
I mean, lots and lots of people who've written about swords from our period have called them clumsy and heavy, and they are. That's what they used, and I'm sure they were very handy with them. These were, you know, these were strong men. They drilled and trained, and they were very accomplished fighters. They knew how to use those things.
Yeah. So going back to sea axes, would they have had that? Because everyone I always see has like a very prominent diagonal sort of cut to it
Wear
at
them
the end.
diagonally.
No,
Oh,
no.
well,
The
no.
actual blade, the actual blade itself. I've always seen them where they have a long, sharp edge, and then the other side stops maybe before the point and comes down at an angle.
Yeah, they're not very common.
Oh, okay. They're the
no,
ones
the,
I always seem to see.
Most of them are conventionally point, you know, have a conventional rounded point, but can be quite sharp. Most of the ones that were found in England are like that. I forget, there used to be a name for those ones that are cut off at the end, but I can't remember what it is. But they're actually quite uncommon.
Oh, they're the ones I always seem to see. But I don't know if maybe that's because those are the ones usually related or associated with Viking. Because I have a replica of
Yeah.
one that was apparently
Broke, oh,
found.
they're called broken back sea axes, aren't they?
Okay. I have a replica of one that was found in the Thames
Yeah.
that has runes on it.
Oh, I know the one.
It's
Very
quite,
long sea axe.
it's really long, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very long.
Have you got all the runes on it?
It begins
You
with
got
a
all the
B.
inlay?
It's got all the runes on the
Right.
blade,
Who
yeah.
made that?
I don't
Not
know.
by Todd.
No, it was a gift. So I don't
Oh,
know.
right.
It was a gift. I never asked because that would kind of let me know how much it was, I guess.
Well, it sounds like a very nice thing. I'm just trying to find a picture of a you know, pretty conventional sax. I don't know if you can see that, but can you see those?
Oh yeah, okay.
Look, that's pretty normal. I mean, these are found all around the North Sea and on the continent. But the broken back saxes are pretty rare, certainly in burials.
Okay. So usually we save the Q&A for the end, but Sophie had a question of how long does a sax have to be before it's a sword? And I think I was probably going to naturally ask that anyway.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
Most sea axes are about, from including the handle, about that long. You know, but. This has got a blade of 72 centimeters. Now there are sea axes or single edge swords with blades that are longer than this. So they're definitely swords. They're
Okay.
but I don't know if anyone's ever actually come up with a definition, really. But so if it's long, it's a single edge sword. If it's short, if it's anything about, I mean, there are swords that are only sort of about, I think the shortest sword, double-edged sword from a grave in England is 52 centimetres, I think.
Okay, yeah, that's not too
Not
long.
very long at all, but that's extremely rare. That's the only one like that. Every other sword that's been discovered is much longer.
So
yeah, it's 52 centimetres.
Would a CX be more of like a utility tool rather
It's an everything thing.
than a weapon, or
I think a man would have worn a sea axe at all times,
okay.
and I think
So kind of like when people carry pocket knives.
Yeah, except these are big.
Yeah,
They
they're a
wouldn't
bit
fit
bigger
into a
than that.
pocket.
Yeah,
But
yeah.
I think they're for hunting. They're for show because lots of them are very nicely made and very highly decorated. But if you need to use one to be offensive with somebody, they're actually very good things to have. But they tend to be quite heavy. They you know, they're quite thick at the back. But
Yeah.
I don't think they're the sort of thing you want to cut up wood with or anything like that. So I think they'd be personally good sea axes. I think would be restricted to punzing and being quite nasty to people.
Okay.
So and for shot.
Because that kind of leads me onto a question that I wanted to ask that I thought of earlier, and that was, when does something, or is there a definition between what is a tool and what is a weapon? Is there like a clear, because I think axes is the one that comes to mind in a sense that, particularly when anybody thinks of Vikings and weapons, you think of an axe. But for me, I think of an axe as a tool. It's for chopping wood. It's for, I never really think of it as that good of a weapon.
If you're a farmer or a farm boy, you know, not, I mean, many farmers would be quite middle class, I suppose, and would have access to, you know, fairly good weaponry, particularly in their family. But if you're a farm boy, you know, who's just sort of trying out for this, then you may well use a tool axe. But war axes are quite specially made. They're very, very different. Okay. And the from our period, I mean, we have my Francisca. It's surrendered.
Paul's just popping off to get something, which I'm hoping is going to be a really cool axe. Who knows? Who knows what he's going to come back with? Anybody who wants to have a look at the pieces that Paul owns and has made, they are unbelievably stunning. I'm hoping we're going to get a chance to talk about the lovely shield he has as well.
I'd like to show it to you, but I can't get it in this room.
Oh, no,
that's
no.
That's a throwing axe, a Francisca, which are relatively, there's a fair few of them in England and Scandinavia. Oh, I don't actually know if there's any or Denmark, but they certainly have them in Germany and France. But these are just so nicely aerodynamic. I can't really see them being used as a tool. I do have a great axe over there, but I can't get at it at the moment.
I'm sure you've got tons of amazing pieces. Were axes thrown as weapons commonly? Well, it feels so counterproductive.
I agree with you. I mean, these are called throwing axes, and we know they were thrown. I think it's Procopius who tells us that, or it might be Procopius of Tours, I can't remember. But he tells us that they're throwing axes. But this is such a nice thing. And to be honest, you know, it's quite nice in the hand. You can do a lot of damage with that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they were thrown sometimes. But you'd want to retrieve it. You wouldn't want to, you know.
Yeah,
just
you wouldn't want to leave
go.
It behind.
No, it's not like a hand grenade, which you certainly wouldn't want back.
No, you don't. Yeah, you definitely don't want that back. I remember reading something a long time ago, and I feel like it's bullshit, but I'm going to put it out there and you can see if you've heard of anything similar. And it was an idea of that throwing axes became popular by lumberjacks because they'd throw it from tree to tree and it would free their hands up whilst pulling or moving the logs. And I feel like you just put it in your belt. But yeah. I don't know. I just remember reading that somewhere and it's always stuck with me and I've always wondered.
This is historical lumberjacks, is it? Or modern lumberjacks?
Historical, I think. I'm trying to think back to when I read
I've
it.
I've never heard that, but
I think historical, but I think it was in terms of North American historical, so not
all right.
Not
all right.
That old.
I don't know. I mean, certainly it's a 6th century example. I can't remember where it's from, but you know, you're not. No one's going to catch that. You're saying they stick it in trees, I suppose. But I could do, but I mean,
yeah, I feel like
you
just
quite
put
a good
it.
Thing to throw. I've done experiments with it, and you can, after a little while, you can stick it in every time. So it's certainly feasible. And of course, if you're throwing at someone with a shield, and it's going to hamper the way they use the shield.
Yeah, it could.
If it sticks in.
It could just be a bit of fun as well. Like they could have just thrown axes as maybe a pastime, and I guess if you had to do it in battle, you would. But it could just be people go to the shooting range or do axe throwing today, and I guess it could be a little bit of a cock measuring contest when people are drinking ale and they're just like,
or
let's see
wine.
who's, yeah, let's see who's the best. I
Yeah.
don't have any axes to throw, actually.
But no, I mean it. Yeah, I don't. Doesn't sound feasible to me, really. But
Yeah.
we do know they were thrown, but I don't know how often they'd be thrown. And they're valuable weapons. I mean, you don't want to lose it.
Yeah. So do you think all, I know you specialize kind of pre-Viking age, but do you think most Vikings were carrying axes like we see depicted in every picture of a Viking ever?
No. No, I don't think so.
Because it is kind of that thing you always see, and it's usually always
It
two
is.
axes as well, one in each hand. They don't take a shield because they don't need
No.
it.
No, I don't. I mean, that there are people in the sagas and things where who don't wear armor and don't wear don't take shields, but no, I don't. I think the ordinary most people who are tooled up to go to battle, they want as much protection on them as they can. And they're certainly not going to relinquish their weapons by throwing them at somebody. I mean, in extremis, you'll do all sorts of things. But you're going to hold on to your spear for as long as you possibly can. And if you're in a situation where you can't, the spear's too long, then you might get out your sword or whatever. So certainly not going to throw this stuff away.
No. So do you think swords would have been more common than
I
an
think
axe on a
swords were.
battlefield?
I think anyone who saw themselves as a warrior for a period of time would have had access to a sword, even if it was loaned to them. I don't. He'd want they, and they would have had an iron cap at least, and a decent shield. Yes, I think that there may have been people on the fringes of the battlefield with bows and all sorts of stuff. Who perhaps didn't have access to swords, but they'd have to be good runners.
It would make complete, because I always, even an axe that's made for fighting, like the big Dane axes, I always feel like they're just a little bit impractical, because if
Well,
you just come if you
I
come
don't.
close, surely that nullifies the
I don't
effect of the
think an
blade.
axeman with the Dane axe, I don't think they worked on their own. I think they were in teams. So there'd probably be two or three of them. There'd be an axeman with a couple of supporters with spears and shield. And I can't really see, standing out the front of the battle waving that thing around. You're a bit of a target.
I feel like as soon as you step in past the blade edge, you're kind of
I mean, that's
vulnerable.
one of the things that fascinates me about exploring the way these weapons are actually used. I mean, one of the things about these swords is they're not designed to hit other swords. The last thing you want to do, well, not necessarily the last thing, but they're designed to hit only one thing, and that's people. And, I'm not saying that they didn't fence with them, but they certainly would avoid edge-to-edge fencing. We do know that happened because there are swords with been found engraved with bits of other swords in them, but most swords aren't like that at all. They're not using swords to fence by and large.
I feel like there's a great comedy skit there of two soldiers having a sword fight, but scared to clash swords, so they just kind of stop right before and are like, no, and then change. Because obviously, we've all seen films where they have these great battles with swords, and you've got the loud clanging everywhere,
Yeah, and they have a chat as well while they're doing
Oh,
it.
yeah, they do love a chat,
You,
don't they?
your
And
mother
insults.
smells of whatever it was. I can't remember, blueberries or something.
They always do have a little bit of a an insult there.
Or
So,
they're going upstairs and having a chat and swinging on chandeliers. Well, the swords weren't made to fence until well late in the Middle Ages. I mean, really, till the Renaissance, then they're made for sword-to-sword combat, edge-to-edge combat. But
so they're mainly made for, I guess, hacking people,
the well,
as
no, the
gruesome as
point.
that is.
What these swords? Well, perhaps, but they can. You get if they thrust you with one of these swords, it will go right through you. So it's
So
they're
they
very
are.
efficient. If you're wearing mail, of course, that would protect you a bit. Depends how good the mouths.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the warriors were martial artists. They trained often. They knew their weapons. They knew the limitations, what they could do with them. And they knew. They would probably be, quite beautiful to watch.
Yeah.
So they were skilled. And although scholars have said these are clumsy, they are. They're blade heavy, but strong man would have no trouble using this in any way that he wants. So.
Okay, so you touched on mail. How common do you think that was? Because there is so much work that has to go into chain mail.
Well, I think it was quite common. I mean,
Really?
I do. Well, Roman
Every time I
soldiers.
look at it, I just it baffles me how many rings must be into each one of these
But like
pieces.
swords, once a mail coat is made, if you look after it and repair it, it can last for a very long time indeed. And I mean, I did a in the book, I do a. I did a thought experiment with swords, and if there was a 10 smiths in England making 10 swords a year, that's 100 swords. 10 years, that's 1,000 swords, plus the ones that were already there. A few would get damaged and destroyed or buried, but most of them are still going to be around in 100 years' time if they're looked after. So you've got a, and it's the same with mail. And don't forget, the Roman army managed to equip pretty much all its soldiers with decent armor, whether it's Lorica Segmentata, which I don't think lasted all that long, but you always see Romans wearing it in films, and mail. There was lots of mail around, and some of that mail that people wore may well have been Roman.
Everything will have been reused, repurposed.
Absolutely.
It's not thrown away. Like, again, looking at everything through modern eyes, we have such a single-use culture where we just throw things away. Whereas back then, it would have been very resourceful.
Absolutely. And there would have been people who specialized in repairing it. So you send your mail off to the mail repairers, and they'd sort it all out for you rather than make a whole coat. And I think we suffer in the scholarly world. I'm not really in the scholarly world. I sort of touch on it a little bit. And I know some people, but I'll pretend to be a scholar, but we've suffered.
You to be fair, you have the obligatory scholarly bookshelf behind you, like most scholars I have on here.
There's a lot more, but anyway, but the many of the older scholars, a couple of generations ago, they were brought up on the classics and Rome and Greece and the rest of it, and everything was lovely until the barbarians came along. And the barbarians were horrible and dirty and couldn't wash themselves and had straggly hair, and they didn't have nice things. I mean, Sun Tzu began to change that idea. That it began to make the ideas of that are presented in Beowulf real. People begin to understand that the Dark Ages were actually not that dark, really. And they were, people who made things like this, they'd done apprenticeships. They worked in workshops and probably the equivalent of quite extensive workshops. And they were not, they were sophisticated. The society was a sophisticated society, with all sorts of levels and people doing all sorts of things. And in the past, it's always been assumed, let's use that word Anglo-Saxons, that the Anglo-Saxons wore brown or green at best, and never combed their hair, and had straggly beards and stunk. Well, you find combs in graves and toilet seats. They're very, very common. People looked after themselves. And I also suspect they wore quite nice colours, because people always like to wear nice colours. So that old idea of once the Romans went, everything was horrible. I don't think it was true at all. They had different sets of skills and they did different things, but they were very, very capable of doing pretty much anything, really, if they put their minds to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I do want to touch on I want to touch on shields and get your thoughts on those. But I think we're going to run out of time to look at the Sutton Hoo item. So if in future you would like to come back, I would love to do an episode on, and we can save it for one episode then, on the Sutton
Okay.
Hoo items and what the symbology might be, and we can look at those. So that would
I'll
be
be very happy
fun.
to do that. No problem.
Wonderful. Let's do that. But I am going to ask you about the hammer axe thing, but we can save that for the Q&A after, because that I find that item very fascinating. So if people do want to learn a little bit about that, you can tune into the Q&A after, because this
You
is
may
a
miss.
yeah that is a very, very fascinating piece to me. So we'll save that
Okay.
for the Q&A just after the main show that we're going to do, because I yeah that's a fascinating piece. But shields in general, if we're just talking about shields from this time, I guess they would have been a very important part of warfare. Is it likely that everybody would have carried one? Do we know
Absolutely.
the shape of them? Do we know what they would look like? Would they have been round or
Round.
okay?
And probably most of them are flat disc, but the Sutton Hoo one isn't. It's lenticular at the ends, on the edge. It's a rolled edge. But
So is in like almost like a UFO shape?
yeah, it's flat. I mean, my we don't know the exact size of the Sutton Hoo shield. The estimate is 34, I think, to 38 inches. But some of the gold plated bronze edge protector survives. So I made mine to it's nearly 36 inches. I want to do it to an old inch yard. But the last 4 inches or so are curved.
Okay.
So it was a bugger to do.
Is there a benefit to that? Have you found a benefit to that, or is it maybe a weight saving thing?
Oh no, it's not a weight saving thing. It's a heavy shield.
Okay.
But I think the Sutton Hoo shield, because of its size, is actually primarily for use on horse.
Okay.
And I think that's the same with many of the Scandinavian ones in Vadsfjord and Vendel, because they're big shields too. And all these people were horse warriors. Forget what you read. They rode horses,
Okay.
and they also were able to fight on horses. I mean, you see pictures on the helmets of warriors carrying spears and fighting. So that's what they did. Whether they deserve the word cavalry or not, I don't know. It depends on your definition of cavalry. But they were all horse warriors. They loved horses. There's lots of evidence for horses in England and elsewhere.
I made a shield once.
Did you?
Yes, yeah, it's quite a funny story. So I read that your shield should be the size from like your knuckles to your elbow times 2 plus 2 inch. Maybe this was just some bullshit somebody put online. So
Right.
that's how I made it. So it's a decent sized
Yeah.
shield. But when I was looking to get the wood, I could only find like 22 millimeter planks.
Wow.
Rather, and I think you're meant to use what, like 10 mil maybe
Yeah.
at the most. So I got 22 millimeter planks, made the shield, cut it all out in my garage. I put a leather on the front face, got some rawhide around the edges, obviously wet it, pulled it round, nailed it, tacked it on, and then went to pick the thing up.
It's heavy.
I still have it. It is ridiculously heavy. You can
What's it? What wood is it?
I think I used a pine.
Oh, it should be okay. But
So
22,
it's
20,
still quite a light, it's still a light wood, but
yeah. I mean,
it.
most shields tend to be about 8 mil
Okay.
thick.
Yeah, so
And
I went overkill.
when you put the leather on them and the glue, it becomes a laminate, so it becomes quite strong. But I don't know if, do you know Roland Vorchecker, Dimicator?
No.
Well, he has experimented with swords and Viking swords and Viking shields. And I think he's got, and Matt Easton of Schola Gladiatoria. And I think the sword and the shield are a weapon system, and you really don't want one without the other. So
Okay.
you're gonna, if you come up against a swordsman who's got a shield and you've only got a sword, you're at a terrible disadvantage. You really need a shield. And what he seems to be saying, and it makes a lot of sense because of the biodynamics. You know, we haven't actually changed. We're still the same sort of shape as the earlier people were. He believes that this is Dimakator, Roland Bolchekar. He believes that you fence with the shield, and then you hold your sword back, and then you wait for an opening. And as soon as you get an opening, you flick in there and cut your opponent as badly as you can. And that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, the other thing about these swords, which militates against fencing, is there's almost no hand protection whatsoever. This will not help you. If a sword slides down there, your hand's going to come off. So these are not
it's just
designed.
Horrible, isn't it? We talk about it so flippantly, but it's all just so horrible.
It is. It's absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's designed to give you the worst day you're ever going to have, but it won't last very long.
No,
so,
I do remember we had a guest on the podcast. I'm trying to remember the gentleman's. I'm sure it was Rolf Warming.
Rolf. Yeah, I know Rolf.
So he
he's
joined
done a lot
us.
Of work on shields.
He did, yeah. So we did an episode on shields, and I remember talking about whether a shield was used offensively or just defensively, because I think a lot of people think that it's just kind of a defensive tool. And I wondered what your thoughts were.
Oh,
on that.
They're offensive. And I mean, if you get someone, if you punch someone with this and hit them in the shield rim, it's not a nice experience. It will hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get them right, you can possibly even kill them if you get them in the neck or under the jaw. But yeah, it's an offensive weapon. I mean, you're also doing your best to protect yourself, but shields are great.
I mean, you could probably crush a man with my shield.
Yeah,
you wouldn't want that on you. I feel like you could just lay that on somebody on the battlefield and just they couldn't get up.
But if your comrades could carry you off, standing
yeah,
on
oh,
your
yeah.
field, I expect. No,
I don't know.
No worries about it collapsing.
Maybe not the way I've been eating recently. I don't know if that could might not even be able to take me on that. okay, is there anything? Okay, the last thing, two-handed weapons. Do we see many of those, or is it because there's such a focus on that shield sword dynamic? Do we not get many other than I guess the spear?
No, I think I don't. I can't think of any weapons that are deliberately designed for two hands. And even the spear, I mean, even the thrusting spear, you ideally still want to have a shield with you, so you're only going to use that in one hand. There are one or two extraordinary sword grips that are long from the Viking period. As far as I'm aware, there's none from our period. But it doesn't mean there weren't any. But all swords are designed to be used one-handed. But no, I don't. I can't think of any.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, let's wrap this up, and then we can just do a quick Q&A with the people watching.
Okay.
And then we can do the Sutton Hoo things in a future episode, because I think they deserve their own, because the pieces you have and some of the imagery on them, we could talk for quite a while about.
I'll try and do that in another room, because I mean, I'll send you pictures of this.
Yeah. We maybe you could send me them beforehand and we can pull them up during the episode, and we can, I think that'll really be worthwhile for people
My
to see.
My shield
them.
Is heavy too, by the way. It's it's a pain in the neck.
It's a beautiful thing.
It is. I think it's the most beautiful thing. I think it's my favorite thing from something.
Oh wow!
It's
okay.
Just particularly if you're out and the sun's shining, and suddenly if you catch it right, and suddenly the gold just lifts off and it blinds you. It's nice.
Yeah.
And in the hall, it shines, getting the fire. It's really, really a lovely thing. But, all the Sutton Hoo stuff is pretty lovely, apart from this thing, which is...
But that thing we're going to talk about soon. okay, so where can people... I don't know if you have an online presence, but where can people get your books, or do you want to name some of your books?
I Woden's Worries is out of print, has been for years. My publisher, Anglo-Saxon Books, as far as I know, is still existing, although I haven't heard from him for ages. He's in his 80s, so he lives on a barge. But he seems to fulfill all the orders. So you can order from him. Most the Sun Tzu Sword book, which I'll bit of advertising.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a chunky old book. And you can get, I think it's still, every now and then Amazon get a load of copies in. And sometimes they do price deals. But when I last looked, they didn't have, they you had to go to secondary seller. And the people sell it on eBay as well. But whether...
I'll message you after, and if you let me know where I could grab some for my website, I'll get some up on there where people can get them nice and easy.
Okay, and the Sun Tzu Stone book, which is in that box, I'm fascinated by the stone, often called the Sun Tzu whetstone, but we only call it the stone because it's definitely a stone.
Yeah.
I don't know where that is. I've got a book of some of that, but that's available too, still, as far as I'm aware.
Wonderful. Okay. So, like I said, if you want to listen to the Q&A after this, you can get that on our Patreon. It's patreon.com/ Nordic Mythology Podcast, and it's £3 a month, 10p a day. You get the whole back catalogue, and you're going to get to find out what that weird little weapon tool thing was that Paul showed us, the hammer axe type thing, which is very unusual, I think, from the Sun Tzu burial. If you want to or can follow the podcast on all the different platforms, it's just Nordic Mythology Podcast. Like I mentioned earlier, the YouTube is where you can watch all the episodes. We have a bunch of clips on there, the full episodes, so you can see myself and the guests and all the different things they hold up. Because sometimes, obviously, as we're talking, guests do hold little bits and pieces up, and it's nice to see that. Also, you can just look at our pretty faces if you want. Sometimes you want to do that. To follow me personally, it's Daniel_Fireand1, obviously the business, Horns of Odin. And I think that's it. So, yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Paul. And I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you.